welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of environment, health, food, policy, and science. And we've had a all too exciting election year and election season, and, you know, a very sad and worrying election result. Just last night, and just wanting to acknowledge that. At the same time, each week on Connect the Dots over the last seven some odd years that the show has been going, we connect the dots between everything going on in our world and how it affects our well-being personally, as families, as neighbors, as communities, as a society, and as you know, kind of residents here and part of the ecological fabric of planet Earth. And that is the theme of the show every week. And we bring on a variety of activists, authors, experts, scientists, policy analysts, filmmakers, you know, and just all around good folks to get at different facets of that. Today, on today's show, you know, I think many people are at least in terms of our listeners, my listeners here on Connect the Dots, are in a state of shock and dismay at the election results. I want to acknowledge that. At the same time, the focus of this program and of all of my reporting on Alternet, Truthdig, in the past, Huffington Post, EcoWatch, and other places, is really focused very closely on actual policies, action opportunities, and where our social policy choices are, where the bad ones are taking us, and what we need the good ones to be. And to that end, I have been very much focused for the last several years, as regular listeners know, on the Trans-Pacific Partnerships and other so-called trade agreements, and have been covering and warning about them since 2014, both on this show and in posts at the various sources that I mentioned. And we're back to talking about that again today. I've said all throughout this election season that I regard the TPP and the trade agreements and their potential, the attempt to passage them, which will launch today, is already launched and underway, is perhaps more serious and endangering to our protection of life and the earth and all its creatures, you know, than any single political figure, no matter how powerful. And especially today, we need to really take a look at that and put the horrors and the distraction and the outcome of the election a little bit to one side to really focus on something that we can have impact on and that we must have impact on. And to that end, I am very delighted to welcome back to Connect the Dots Adam Weissman, who has come here on the show many, many times to inform me and my listeners in the past, and has also been a tireless activist, a grassroots organizer, and highly effective, unrelenting, a great role model. I regard him as an amazing role model for all of us who would be environmental activists, and we need to know what's coming towards us now in terms of the TPP and what to do about it. And, you know, I've you know, a lot of time and energy has been, and money and public focus and attention is placed on these elections. And the key issues like the, you know, the TPP and the other trade agreements are really left in the shade by mainstream media. You know, Adam has been relentlessly focused upon the trade agreements throughout this entire cycle to the point that I personally, as closely as I've been lucky to be informed by him and work with him over these past several years, I don't even know what his political agenda was, and I'm not going to ask him today. Although we will cover, you know, just a little bit about how the Trump election, what that kind of context that will provide for this imminent struggle to stop the TPP in the Congress. So welcome to Connect the Dots once again. So happy to have you here, Adam Weissman.
Good morning, Allison. What a morning it is. But
really?
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, so glad you could be here. Let's just summarize for our listeners before we kind of go into the TPP and do a brief summary about what the problems with it are and why, you have dedicated such an effort, and I've really made it one of my primary focuses in reporting, you know, why we're so concerned about it. So we'll do a summary, but let's just do a backward glance at the election cycle that we've just come through, and, you know, where we thought we were in terms of, fighting the TPP and the next president, and where we may or may not be now, or what we may not know about where we are now in terms of the presidential candidates and what has changed between what we thought was a likely outcome several days ago and what the context that we're in now.
Right. So the story of this election cycle in many ways was the voters' revolt against the failed model of NAFTA-style trade deals. The one issue where, in the end, every candidate who made it anywhere in this election agreed upon was that TPP was a bad deal that needed to be rejected. It was a big issue for Bernie Sanders. It was a big issue for Donald Trump, ultimately. And Hillary Clinton, in order to position herself to succeed in this election, well, what she thought would bring her to success in this election, as became really apparent through WikiLeaks, was that she ultimately reversed herself after talking about TPP as the gold standard of trade deals. As a candidate, she was forced to change her tune and come out against TPP. And that was not, as became apparent through WikiLeaks, because she was reacting to the final text of the agreement or because she TPP wasn't what she hoped it would be, but because she realized that the strength of voter opposition and the organized movements in her base against TPP would make it politically untenable for her to support this trade deal. So really across the board, from the left to the right, it became a political obligation for candidates in this election to stand against TPP, and it became politically advantageous for candidates who had a track record of standing against these kind of trade deals to champion that position. And
well, that's very interesting. Let me just interject a question here, which is, what you're saying there implies another question, which is, I think one of the problems with Clinton is that many people did not find her record to be consisting, her parsing of different sides of an issue into some kind of cohesive but sort of cognitively dissonant compromise statement to be very persuasive or convincing. And people were, even those who never suspected otherwise, never read WikiLeaks, had reasons to doubt how consistent her opposition truly was, especially ever since the Democratic Party platform meetings with Bernie Sanders, where she and those voting for her and representing her at those meetings had ample opportunity to firmly reject the TPP and kind of backed away from taking that position with some kind of covering statement, out of deference to the outgoing president and his wishes, as if a world-changing economic global trade agreement with huge economic and environmental impacts should just be kind of agreed to based on our liking for one individual political leader who's now in a lame duck position. So that, wasn't very convincing. Do you feel that the TPP could have really played a major role in responses to it in the outcome of this election?
Yeah, I do. I think that, I've talked to Trump voters who say that his opposition to TPP was an important part of why they supported him, who feel like the working class has gotten screwed by the NAFTA model of trade deals, who blame the Clintons as being the family that gave us NAFTA. And clearly, I mean, if there's one narrative that's become clear in this election, it is that Hillary Clinton, for better or for worse, is made to pay for the crimes of her husband. I mean, if she's mm-hmm. the fact that Trump was castigating, who is a vile sexist abuser of women, was castigating Hillary Clinton throughout the election for the things her husband did to women. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Hillary was made to be held accountable for the policies her husband pushed is really not surprising. At the same time, Hillary herself has not been a consistent and strong opponent of free trade deals. She, mm-hmm. as a candidate, supported the U.S.-Peru free trade agreement. She did, it is true, vote along with every Democrat in the Senate and all but 15 in the House against the U.S. Central America free trade agreement, but she didn't do that with Peru, which is a disastrous trade deal that resulted in a massacre. Her State Department actually encouraged the Peruvian government to use force to suppress protesters who rose up against a basically an executive facilitated land grab that took place under the pretext of implementing the U.S.-Peru FTA, which resulted in the Bagua massacre, which has been described as the Amazon's Tiananmen Square. And as a presidential candidate who had opposed the later Bush trade agreements, who supposedly was going to be an opponent of agreements like the trade deals with Colombia and South Korea, she then, as Secretary of State, towed the line following President Obama, who also supposedly had opposed those deals, in pushing those deals, and then went on to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She authored an article called America's Pacific Century in Foreign Policy and Magazine, and that really outlined this plan of a Pacific pivot that included both a military aspect and an economic diplomatic aspect in the form of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so she was a big part of this TPP agenda. Then you have, by contrast, Donald Trump, who has actually, people say Donald Trump has no positions, that he takes on positions every week. I saw a TV talking head say, Donald Trump had just said 5 years ago he didn't have any position on these trade agreements. This is just something he discovered. That's absolutely not true. The one area where Donald Trump actually does have a consistent political line is on trade deals. He's been a critic of these kind of trade deals since the 80s. You can look up and find videos of him 5 years ago on MSNBC railing against the Korea-U.S. FTA, the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. So this actually is a consistent position he's taken, much more so than Hillary Clinton. And while he's taken 9 or 10 positions per issue on many other issues, on trade policy, he's actually been fairly consistent for a long time. And there are a lot of voters who really recognize that these trade deals are the reason that, are a big part of the reason why the U.S. has been deindustrialized, why middle-class jobs have evaporated, and see Trump as someone who's speaking to that anger and frustration. Now, you can point out the fact that Trump has taken advantage of offshoring in the production of his own product lines. You can call him a hypocrite for taking advantage of the same system that he supposedly is against, that he's talking about keeping jobs at home, but he hasn't done that to produce his own product. And those are all valid points. But in terms of the policy positions he stood for, he has stood against these trade deals. And for people who are not bothered by his the racist scapegoating politics that he's tied that agenda to, for people who actually find that appealing, for people who accept the same package of positions that have been pushed by people like Pat Buchanan and Lou Dobbs, the paleoconservative politics of America first, seal up our borders, keep jobs at home, let's get rid of free trade deals and isolate ourselves economically and make our country stronger. If you can accept that whole package of positions, if you can accept an anti-free trade agenda that is tied, that is in fact part of an agenda that includes also racism and xenophobia, and that these aren't, and if that appeals to you, then Trump is your candidate. I mean, this is not some strange amalgam of random positions. He actually is speaking to a longstanding political worldview that is represented by people like the late Phyllis Schlafly, that's represented by people like the John Birch Society. This is not some strange assortment of positions. There's an actual outside the mainstream conservative politics that he appeals to, that people like Breitbart are part of, which is why Breitbart has been so key, has been so important to his campaign, why they've been such strong backers of him, and why Steve Bannon became such a critical part of his campaign. So this really, I mean, and this is not just an isolated phenomenon. This is the same politics that pushed Brexit. It's almost an identical political line. Let's cut ourselves off, kick out the immigrants, and just be an island nation, and scapegoat the others, and redirect our frustration direct our frustration at the policy elites who've sold us down the river with this globalist agenda, but at the same time also push this tie that to this politics of isolationism that scapegoats the most vulnerable and, in fact, scapegoats people who have been victims of the same agenda. I mean, the absurdity of Donald Trump and his push for a wall with Mexico is that a huge part of the reason for Mexican immigration is the same NAFTA trade deal that he himself has decried. NAFTA was devastating for Mexicans. NAFTA pushed for the privatization of ejidos, which are collective farms. NAFTA greatly exacerbated the drug war in Mexico by creating a pipeline for the drug trade to come into the U.S., which expanded U.S. involvement in the drug war in Mexico and ramped up what had been a very much existing but somewhat quiet drug trade into a human rights nightmare. NAFTA contributed to the militarization of Mexico. In response, NAFTA led to the loss of land for millions of peasant farmers. NAFTA sent factory jobs to Mexico, it's true, but those jobs didn't stay there when they were able to find even lower wage economies. NAFTA contributed to factories enjoying the lower regulatory climate of Mexico that polluted the environment. NAFTA encouraged companies like Smithfield Foods to set up factory farms that damaged people's health. Maybe there's an argument that the swine flu epidemic that led to 18,000 deaths was a direct consequence of Smithfield Foods setting up a factory farm in Veracruz, Mexico, in the wake of NAFTA. And
let me just interject here for a second, because you've listed, and obviously your knowledge of this is just comprehensive and fantastic. But you know what you're saying here, just to kind of go back to the global point, is that NAFTA, the original kind of trade agreement of them all, or the most major one that these trade agreements build on, and they've been called NAFTA on steroids. In other words, they take it much more intensively and worse, actually created the very conditions that hurt many populations, both in Mexico, as you point out, and in this country in terms of people's job loss and loss of homes and economic opportunity. So it's actually policy decisions that were created in the Bush and Clinton administrations that created all of these economic hardships, these health problems, this disaffection that is the context or the milieu in which a larger swath of the population is affected and contaminated. And then instead of targeting the correct cause, instead, in some sense, they do know the cause, which is why Rust Belt states voted against Clinton, both in the primary and in the election. But basically, it's as if, again, as you said, Bill Clinton and his administration and his work and the work that Hillary Clinton was also part of created the very conditions that now create this large, disaffected, and brutally racist hateful segment of the population frustrated because they don't have a voice, that actually creates the conditions for Trump's election. I mean, that's what you're in effect saying, and that one segment of his policies, which are taking us backward in so many ways, is to kind of put a stall on further of these trade agreements that have, already kind of pulled the plug on the economic well-being that was more of a groundwork in this country. I mean, that's what I take away from, like, what you're saying. And, and one of the things, too, is that the classes of people who were either most directly economically impacted in this country or who were challenged by the influx of immigrants who were economically and in other ways impacted in their own native countries and then came here, it's those groups of people who are actively suffering from the effects of the NAFTA trade agreement, and many more will be joining them if these other trade agreements are signed globally. It's that population that then, and that whole dynamic that was in effect created by the same larger global power infrastructures, corporate infrastructures that represented the establishment, and people were rejecting that. And then another group of people were saying, no, give us a little more time, we'll sort of fine tune it, because the severe economic impacts had yet to impact, liberals, and others who were therefore like more, well, if the President Obama says it's a good thing, these are people we like, it can't be that bad. So that's in effect a key dynamic in both sides of this election is about these trade deals. And I think one of the things that people forget is they want to characterize a certain population, say someone is racist, a hateful person, has no ethics or, moral sense or whatever, is cruel, is hostile, is angry, is, all of that. But it's not just about, when you have so many people feeling this way, it's not just about a bunch of bad apples. It's about a systemic problem that we all have, been on either the up or the down or the middle side of and not paying close enough attention to, that has built a context that is now so divided and so troubled and in some sides so hateful as our own. And what you're detailing is that the trade agreements have already done this tremendous harm. We're not paying close enough attention to that as we focus on, who we hate on the other side or these horrible policies. What will the next round of TPP and succeeding trade agreements bring in and create if we allow them to be passed as they are coming up for a vote in President Obama's lame duck session of Congress?
Yeah, well, before I speak to that, I just want to reinforce one more point about the political moment and where and what we can learn from it. Because, I mean, the Democratic, it became so clear from WikiLeaks and from anyone just watching that the Democratic National Committee was working so hard to try to suppress the Sanders voters. And that whole movement, whether you like Bernie Sanders or don't like Bernie Sanders, it was clear that there was a groundswell of organized voter frustration, a grassroots movement that was speaking to real voter concerns, in a way that made this candidate who in so many ways. I mean, well, no pun intended, just came out of left field and seemed not at all, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, would have seemed not politically viable, that this candidate on small contributions was making a real challenge to Hillary Clinton, who was supposed to be the shoe and who was supposed, the founding slogan of her campaign, it's her turn, this whole sense that she was inevitably the next president, that this socialist, so-called socialist from Vermont was mounting a real challenge, in part was based on the same kind of populist frustration, the same kind of grassroots rejection of the economic elites, of policies like TPP that were fueling the Trump campaign. And the Democratic establishment yet again ignored those signs, just as and went with the establishment candidate, and went and who was the worst possible candidate for this time in so many ways. A candidate who had such direct associations with TPP. A candidate who has a long history of supporting these kind of trade deals. When they had the opportunity to back an opponent who actually could go toe-to-toe with Trump on these issues, who has that history, who has that populist fervor, that they again believe that supporting centrist, moderate Democrats who support neoliberal policies and who draw their strength from the banking elites was their path to power. And it failed. And it failed badly. And what I think as a grassroots movement of the left, we now need to do is really say that that what Bill Clinton started in many ways, I mean, in some ways even Jimmy Carter started it, but what Bill Clinton really brought to fruition, the DLC wing of the Democratic Party, the third way moderate neoliberal Democrats who sound like Republicans wing of the Democratic Party, that wing has to be dead now because it's failed. Because it has been proven to not be electorally viable. Donald Trump has no business winning this election. He had no business getting anywhere near this point. But the Democrats fielded such an obsolete model in terms of the politics behind the candidate they put forth, and to send Bill Clinton up. You know, and again, it was Hillary running, but the idea that Bill Clinton would have been back in the White House for a lot of people in the wake of NAFTA was untenable, and it's just almost waving a red flag in the face of voters who were screwed by NAFTA and were screwed by permanent normalization of trade relations with China and so many of the trade agreements that followed. So we now cannot let the Democrats come back and say, well, you know, we need to try again next time with another centrist mainstream candidate who's going to be funded by the banks and who has a history of giving speeches to Goldman Sachs and who has a history of connections to Walmart. We need to say that right populism is only going to be stopped by populism of the left, by a populism that's going to reject the neoliberal agenda, by a politics that's going to reject corporate globalization, but that is not going to do so at the cost of scapegoating the most vulnerable, at the cost of demonizing the very victims of these policies. You know, I talked about NAFTA, but we can also look at the U.S. Central America Free Trade Agreement, which had a big role in driving the Central American refugee crisis. Add to that the fact that Hillary Clinton herself had a very questionable role in the coup in Honduras, which also drove Central American migration as Honduras became the murder capital of the world. And so Hillary Clinton was not the right candidate to come back and say that the scapegoating of victims is not appropriate when she opposed the Central America Agreement, that's true, but she was not someone who was a strong opponent of these kind of trade policies, and she was not someone, certainly not someone who was a strong opponent of imperialist coups or backing coups for imperialist reasons. So she was not the right person to stand against these policies. We need to frame a politics that is anti-neoliberal, but also anti-racist and anti-scapegoating and anti-xenophobia. And that's the politics that is going to be able to unite a movement of people who stand for economic justice, but also for racial justice, who stand against corporate globalization, but also stand against bigotry. And that's where we need to, in the next 4 years and beyond, frame our opposition, because unfortunately, without that a strong politics coming out of the ostensible left as an alternative for people, a lot of that frustration has flowed to the right. We saw that with Brexit, because of the fact that a lot of Brexit was fueled by xenophobia. It was also fueled by frustration at the transatlantic trade and investment partnership coming down the pike. It was also fueled by the sense that the EU stripped the UK of national sovereignty, and that detached EU bureaucrats were making decisions that were affecting people's lives without their consent. And being able to say that we, the people, deserve our own democracy, that we need to make our own decisions, and that they need to reflect the interests of working people, that is absolutely a message that we need to champion. And we need to say that the problem is not scapegoating the most vulnerable is not appropriate, that the blame needs to be pointed at the economic elites who have pushed these kind of policies, and that it's grassroots popular resistance and organizing working people that's going to be the alternative, not championing racist demagogues. So in terms of what that means for the fight against TPP and other trade agreements in the short term and the long term, well, this lame duck period coming up is still going to be politically critical. We still need to be vigilant in the fight against TPP. It is a possibility that President Obama, now recognizing that there's no chance TPP is going to pass in 2017, is still going to try to ram TPP down our throats in the lame duck session and rush through a vote. We need to be letting our members of Congress know that this is not an appropriate time to say, well, this is Obama's last best chance to forge his legacy with this trade deal. These kind of policies are the reason Donald Trump was elected, to send the message to voters that we're still going to go ahead after seeing Donald Trump elected out of voter frustration to these policies is political suicide in the long term, for both for the individual candidates and for the politics that they represent, and is a disastrous decision to make for voting people. People were not wrong in rejecting this free trade agenda. Personal opinion, they were wrong. And for those of them who chose to vote for Trump as a result, speaking only for myself here, I say that only because we're organizationally nonpartisan, but unequivocally, I will say for myself that people who, on the basis of that frustration, supported Trump made the wrong decision. But the reality is that there were real frustrations with these kind of trade deals that partly fueled that vote. So to say, we have to finish off the Obama legacy by pushing through this trade deal. Yeah, we also may as well finish off any hope of digging ourselves out of this ditch. Our elected officials now need to look towards the future, and that future is not going to be a future of these kind of trade deals. And God only knows what kind of trade deals are the good trade deals that Donald Trump says he's going to forge in place of them. I think we can be sure that they're not going to be trade deals that have strong environmental safeguards. So the idea that we can just go home now and the fight against free trade is done, we shouldn't in any way be assured of that. Donald Trump didn't say, I'm going to end free trade, I'm going to end trade deals. He said, he wants better deals. He's also a climate denier. So as someone who works with an organization that is fighting for more environmentally sustainable trade policies, this is, I'm not confident that the fact that TPP is not something that a Trump administration is going to push, that he's probably not just going to pick up the baton on TTIP and TISA and the U.S.-China Bilateral Investment Treaty, means that we have a future of environmentally sustainable international trade policies. There's also the reality that Donald Trump is a proven liar. So many people are saying, how can you even trust that Trump is going to stick to these positions? And that's a fair question. But so we don't get to retire after today. This doesn't mean we can breathe a sigh of relief and the battle is won. We absolutely need to be keeping the pressure on our electeds and letting them know that we absolutely cannot have a lame duck TPP vote. People may need a day today to recollect and mourn, but strategize. But looking ahead, the No Lame Duck Uprising is coming up from the 12th to the 17th in Washington, D.C., led by our friends at Popular Resistance and Flush the TPP. On the 17th, there's a national rally in Washington. The 15th through the 17th are national call-in days against TPP. The 15th is a thunderclap action, which I've said is the laziest anti-TPP action of all. If you don't have time to do anything else, at the very least, please participate in the thunderclap. All you have to do is click on a button, and your Twitter and Facebook are connected to this online alert that will be messaged out from your account on 9:30 a.m. on the 15th. on coming back to New York on the 21st. We're going to be rallying at Congressman Rangel's office, who has told people that if President Obama asks him to vote for TPP, he will. Then on the 22nd, again in New York, and we'll try to live stream this for people around the country, an animal group, Collectively Free, is doing a forum that I'll be speaking on TPP's impact for animals. On the 16th, for our friends in the New York area, there are two different events, one that's being organized by the New York Society for Ethical Culture, along with a panel of Latin American activists against TPP, activists from Latin American nations fighting TPP who want to have a North-South dialogue on fighting this and other trade deals, which I think particularly in light of today becomes even more important. And then on the going ahead to the 30th, we're going to have a national lobby day against TPP that will be followed by a Rock Against the TPP concert. So it's a packed month of action, and we need to keep pushing. We need to get ourselves through the end of this year and then gird ourselves for what comes next. But this fight is unfortunately not over yet. I know I've just thrown a whole bunch of events at listeners, and I wasn't expecting people to be scribbling them all down. But what you can do is go to tradejustice.net and click on the upcoming events page, or you can go to gjae.org, that's the website of Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, and click on the upcoming events link and find all of the events I've listed here and many others that will be scheduled in the days to come. And I mentioned a bunch of New York events, but you can be assured that in whatever city you live in or whatever area you live in, there are activists fighting against TPP, and if there aren't, well, you need to be leading the charge. Also, if you check the House calendar, which you just go online and look up House calendar, you'll see that the House of Representatives is not in session much at all in the next 2 months. They have just a few days in office when they have the chance of voting for TPP. That means that the rest of the time they'll be home in district. And during that time, you know, they don't have the excuse anymore of, well, we have an election to think about and, you know, we're really busy. They need to be meeting with us. We need to be meeting with them. We need to be visiting their offices. We need to be protesting outside their offices if that's what it takes, if they still haven't taken a position against TPP. But today and tomorrow, call your elected officials' offices. Set up a meeting for the next time they're in district. Say that you want to talk to them about TPP. Arrange your friends from the local environmental group and talk to your local union organizers and groups working on access to medicines issues and groups working on health care rights and groups working on safe food and groups working on animal protections and family farmers and all the movements that are affected by TPP. There's been people speaking out against TPP from the movement to Black Lives to the National Organization for Women to just about every social movement you can think of has reason to oppose TPP, and we need to bring all those people together and bring them to our elected officials and say, this is what happens when people aren't listening to the voters, when we don't have a strong enough voice against these kind of trade deals. We need to not repeat that mistake. Now we must stand united against these trade deals, because there's a real cost to all of our lives if they go ahead, and secondly, because there's a real political cost to supporting them, to not being seen as a credible opponent to them. So we need to ask our elected officials if you want the same fate that Hillary Clinton suffered for not being seen as a credible opponent to these trade deals. And yes, she came out against TPP, but it also was clear that it was her supporting President Obama that kept strong TPP language or stronger TPP language out of the Democratic Party platform. She was not out there campaigning to push members of the House and Senate to vote against TPP in the lame duck session. That was a courtesy to President Obama, but maybe if she'd been a stronger voice there, if people saw her as a more believable opponent of TPP, there would have been a more enthusiastic base to support her. So we need to ask our elected officials, do you want to commit political suicide by not being seen as a strong opinion of this politically toxic agenda of neoliberal free trade deals? If you want a political future...
Let me just interject something here, Adam,
sure.
Because, I think you create some really strong arguments And one of the things that I've noticed is that in the Democratic campaign, there were a whole group of people who were together and enthusiastic during the primary on the wave of Bernie. Then we hit up against the, you know, the wall of an apparent victory, but that was, at least in part, media abetted and orchestrated due to the superdelegates, as well as election integrity issues, better documented long after the primaries and during it. And so then this created a division. And I think there are many liberal and left-leaning, environmentally caring people who, you know, were rightfully fearful, were part of targeted groups of, you know, Trump's horrible attacks on minorities and all of that, had, you know, family members who were targeted or their, you know, themselves, and who were just triggered and terrified of his taking control as he now has. And that was framed by the Democratic Party into being, you know, the primary unifying issue. So in effect, more diehard progressives and you know, kind of committed Sanders reporters or people who went green were on one side of the spectrum, although that group certainly doesn't include anyone who hates minorities or wanted to see this kind of horrific agenda enacted. You know, but maybe we're more serious about policy issues, concerned about warmongering, concerned about the TPP, concerned about you know, money in politics and the control by multinational corporations of our elected officials and government. But a certain group, you know, kind of went with Clinton because that was our best shot at, you know, protecting minorities and having a more inclusive social agenda. So in effect, the social agenda was co-opted or, you know, was seen as like the primary flag bearing of the Democratic Party. But these other, you know, but the TPP, which requires further analysis and economic understanding, and I think many people who were, you know, kind of well-off liberals could not understand the depth of harm that had been done to the segments of the population who ultimately voted for Trump, as well as many on the left, right? So it's that ignorance, because this has fallen into this media blackout. You know, many people who call themselves environmentalists, eco-feminists, and all the rest of it are not really that well-informed or aware of what the environmental and other, you know, economic risks of these, of the passage of these trade agreements would be. Can you, and that's how we got divided, and I see now there's an absolute urgency to get back together. Could you just do a brief orientation to the most egregious environmental threats that would come in with the TPP and its subsequent agreements?
Sure. And there are so many, it's hard to even know where to start. But just to mention a few, one of them is the fact that TPP and agreements like it are more than just trade deals. They're also corporate investor rights agreements. They empower corporations to sue our government and sue any of the member governments, foreign companies to sue our governments in international tribunals outside the jurisdiction of a member nation's court system, where they can demand unlimited compensation or unlimited sums in compensation for loss of expected future profits. So just a couple examples of where that's come to play under past trade deals. Very recently, the U.S. is now facing a $15 billion lawsuit under the North American Free Trade Agreement because President Obama blocked the Keystone XL pipeline. There's a case in Canada right now where the Canadian government is being sued by a company called Lone Pine Resources because of a moratorium on fracking in Quebec. There's also a case just recently that came up with Canada where opposition to offshore wind farms, in part based on concerns for their impact on bird populations, there's a moratorium on those wind farms. And that triggered a suit under NAFTA for $25 million. There have been many cases. There's a case in Mexico against a toxic dump site that was successful in support of the polluters. There have been cases around pesticides where pesticide bans have been overturned. And so investor state dispute settlement is a way for corporations to attack public interest regulation and make it create a chilling effect on the passage of public interest laws and regulations and court rulings based on attaching a price tag to them, where countries are liable for the full profit potential that an unregulated environmental harm would give to corporations. Add to that the fact that these trade deals that one of the biggest beneficiaries is industrial agriculture, that this is really a big part of pushing the global factory farm economy, that the big meat, dairy, and agribusiness interests were a big supporter of these trade deals, creating new opportunities to attack food safety rules, to lowering tariffs that allowed for more export of factory farm products, to attacking bans on genetically modified foods, to undermining food inspection standards. This was a great opportunity to continue the corporatization of our food supply at the expense of animals' lives, at the expense of the safety of our food, and at the expense of environmentally sustainable food production. Add to
that's
that
terrific.
The fact
I just
that-
want to. I just before we go further, I just want to ask one more thing, because you know the when you talked about the international tribunals and you know where what the status of those are and the and you know incredible effect they would have, I think probably I must have in the last 3 years that I've been covering this, you know, 10 different programs where we talk about these international tribunals. And, you know, obviously they sound very frightening. People have trouble believing that such a thing could come in. One of the things that happens is that when we cite what has gone on and how those, you know, how those deals come down, you know, frequently we're talking about countries abroad. And one of the things, you know, I mean, obviously the KXL is an exception, but, you know, I think people really have a problem picturing what, you know, one of the things that I hear all the time is people saying, well, if it doesn't work on the federal government level, we're just going to take it down to our community and deal with it on a local level, and we'll all have our own local gardens and, you know, and this and that. And I think people really don't understand how these trade deals, if enacted in the provisions within them, would follow us into our communities and block the kinds of things that we are imagining is, you know, will help us to evade what is going on either at, you know, in government, at the federal level, you know, and create a better and more survivable future for ourselves. Could you, instead of talking about the deals that have passed, give our listeners a few examples of the kind of ways that these, if these provisions become law, they could reach into your community, your neighborhood, your local decision-making process, your capacity to control or protect or have any kind of say in your food, in your water, in your local environment? How could that actually happen? Because that's what we're really talking about here.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, and what you talk about in terms of local policy and local food, these trade agreements really go on the attack against this shift towards trying to localize our food supply, towards trying to localize our economies. They directly attack the ability of government, which is one example. One of the ways that we can help to build local economies are by things like buy local rules, by government purchasing, by local policies, where, I mean, wouldn't it be a beautiful thing if your local schools could actually support your local farmers so we could actually build a local food economy? If local institutions, if our state government purchasing said, hey, you know, wouldn't it be great if New Jersey, for example, my state where I live, would buy tomatoes grown in New Jersey and would buy corn grown in New Jersey and would support our local farmers and decrease the environmental impact of shipping food a world away and buy food in season. And that kind of policy, by local policies, are directly under attack by these kind of trade agreements. They limit our ability to pass government procurement rules that are discriminatory against foreign competitors. And so that also means that things like trying to build a green economy by things like Buy American policies that can help to foster the development of green jobs industries. Are directly undermined. If we want to create an economy of fair-waged workers doing environmentally friendly work, if we want to build solar panels, if we want to build safe wind farms, if we want to shift towards more energy efficient more energy efficient technologies, and do that production at home and create decent paying jobs for working people, that's directly undermined by the agenda of these trade deals. They are designed to shift jobs to the lowest wage economies with the lowest environmental standards, and then allow products to be imported back into the United States, rather than producing at home where we can maintain high labor standards, maintain high environmental standards, and in fact say to the rest of the world and say to the corporations that this is the way you access our market, that you access our market not by driving down standards to drive down prices, but by raising standards. Ross Perot talked about a name that maybe some of us are thinking about again today. Talked about a social tariff, the idea that we should have social responsibility standards on what we import from corporations, so that it does not become advantageous to say, well, the U.S. has this state has high environmental standards, the U.S. has environmental rules for how we produce goods, so let's just produce overseas where we can produce more cheaply and then import back into the U.S. Well, that not only circumvents the whole reason for passing those regulations, but it also disincentivizes passing those kind of rules. If you're going to pass an environmental rule, and all that it's going to mean is that workers here are going to lose their jobs because corporations will move production to a place where they don't have those kind of rules, it pits workers against the environment because workers very reasonably want to stay employed. It undermines our ability to push for good policy because it makes environmental standards a job loser. And the only winner is the big corporations who are able to produce more cheaply and make goods that are cost competitive against goods that are produced with higher standards. And you know, some of that translates to lower prices for consumers, but a lot of it really just means higher profit margins for the corporations. I mean, if we were actually paying the real cost of some of the goods that we're buying, when you look at the cost of labor and when you look at the low regulation environments where products were produced, we wouldn't be paying what we're paying for products like iPhones. It's certainly not, you know, they're certainly not compensating the labor cost through people jumping into suicide nets at Foxconn in order to produce these goods that cost hundreds of dollars. Part of the push for this trade deal was corporations feeling like wages were not low enough in China, so they wanted to be able to produce goods in Vietnam, which has an even lower minimum wage, and export them back into the U.S. tariff-free. So we do need to rebuild our local economies. We do need to support high standards, both internationally and at home, and we need to fight this whole free trade agenda of a global race to the bottom of producing the countries with the lowest food safety standards, the lowest environmental standards, the lowest wage standards, the lowest labor rights, the worst union busting, and say that if what we need to raise across the board are international labor rights, our environmental standards, our consumer protection standards, our food safety rules, our animal protection rules, and that's the standard that we're going to create for market access, that we're not just going to push towards knocking down international barriers for corporate profit, but then and making the only area where we increase restrictions things like corporate intellectual property that let companies raise the cost of drugs or by keeping generics off the market. The irony is that TPP wasn't even a free trade deal. If it was really a free trade deal, this whole aspect that was so important to people like Orrin Hatch, the Senate Finance Chair, whose only big objection to TPP was that it wasn't regulatory enough in terms of preventing generic drugs, that it wasn't extending the patent term for biologic drugs in every participating country to 12 years, which would have been a death sentence for people who need life-saving medicines. So so we need to say, yeah, there is a clear message here as to what we need. We want to be able to have democracy. We want to be able to pass our own rules. And to the degree that we want to globalize, it's towards high standards that are in everyone's best interest, that allow us to have a sustainable future of breathable air and drinkable water and edible food, not just towards making the billionaires even richer.
Exactly. And, you know, even if we're creeping, I think, you know, even if we're creeping along, or some of us are, and, you know, we think we're doing okay, I think there's a real, you know, not really a good sense of where other people in our country outside of our economic group or bubble, you know, might happen to be. And I think people are really hurting, and this isn't, this is fueling racism and all the rest of it. You know, before we just check out here, I just want to mention, because I don't think I gave you a proper intro at the beginning of the program here today on Connect the Dots. We've been speaking with Adam Weissman, who works at Trade Justice New York Metro, Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, and, you know, really has a long history of tremendous volunteer activity in activism. Today, you know, and it's something really to model and think about. You know, it's not that there are some people who have this as a job and then everyone else just sits back and does what they do and they, you know, they just do a little this and that occasionally. We're all going to have to learn from people like Adam to really step up and participate, and also to read alternative news sources, to diversify our group of friends, because what I see in my cohort, despite, you know, banging the drum on this now for 3 years and everything, is a lot of people in the older generation who, there are some and many who get it, who are well-informed, and many others who really, you know, just see the racist card played, hate the people, and want to write them off without understanding what brought us and them to this juncture. So, you know, you're a terrific role model for that. I'd like to recommend that people go to the Trade Justice website that you mentioned and look at these actions and activities, because, you know, it's, take a group of friends. I mean, you know, get a couple of people together. Go, as Adam suggested, to any local organization you belong to in any of the sectors affected, environment, food, whatever, and, you know, make an appointment. Go with several people. Meet with your senator or congressional representatives in person when they're on break, as you know, as they will be often during the next month and more, to really meet with them and use some of the arguments in this program to let them know, you know, that you're watching, you're paying attention, you're ready to walk the extra yard and mile to stop these trade agreements. And, you know, it's not just about personalities and the candidates, you know. So I just want to thank you so much, Adam Weissman of New York, Trade Justice New York Metro, for being with us today on Connect the Dots, and for all your terrific work and organizing. You're really a model for us all. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's keep fighting.
We will keep
fighting. The people who are going to be under attack in the weeks and months to come.
I know. And thank you, listeners. And, you know, please join the fight and step up. Keep on stepping up. And join me next week on Connect the Dots, 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern. I'm Allison Rose Levy.